If you really want to be part of new technology, you have to be in Asia. And most of the time you have to be in China. That's the harsh reality. And we saw it so much in when it comes to wind and solar. It doesn't really pay to look at everywhere, anywhere else. And we see the same now with batteries. We see the same thing with chips manufacturing, not maybe in China, but then it's rather Korea and Taiwan instead. So you have to, I mean, this is the part of the world where it's all happening. I think the average growth of GDP for the last 25 years in Poland is 3.8%.
Yes, yes.
It's not China, but it's not far from China either. And that's here in Europe, it's 40 million people. We, for example, if you look at one of the new countries that we have been investing in for the last 10 years maybe, is Saudi Arabia, which was not in any indices when we started to invest in it. I think it is a fantastic business to be in. It's really, I mean, you are paid to be curious. So I would just, if you're interested in what's happening in the world, this is the dream.
Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. If this is your first time joining, I'm your host, Simon Brewer. Quick word before we start. 95% of viewers aren't subscribed, so miss out on future interviews with top business, finance, and industry leaders. To support the show and ensure we can keep sharing high-quality content, click subscribe and please drop a like. Plus, if you have any future guest ideas, do share your suggestions in the comments section below. Otherwise, thank you for watching and listening, and enjoy the show.
Emerging markets, once the darling of the asset allocators world, have found themselves increasingly discarded by those same allocators. Initially, post the great financial crisis and exacerbated by COVID, such became the reallocation away and the magnetism of the US and its platform technology companies that by the end of 2024, emerging markets were at a 50-year low relative to the S&P 500. As always happens at such potential inflection points, tomes are written about the developments, often justifying the current state of affairs, equally forgetting that mean reversion, the role of cycles, and that investment returns are a function of the price you pay, which means that when the elastic band of valuation is stretched excessively, even modestly contrarian bets can pay off handsomely. A few of these forces have triggered some incipient flows of capital by allocators away from the US this year, which in turn has moved the anti-emerging market trend a touch. Is this a flicker? Or are we at the foothills of a bigger reallocation and a recognition that with the US equity market at over 65% of global stock markets, even modest shifts in allocations can have important effects on prices? As former guest Peter Frankopan reminded us, over two-thirds of the world's population lives east of Istanbul. 75% of the world's hydrocarbons, 85% of the world's rice production, rare earths, both in availability and process, and much more also reside there. Therefore, it seemed appropriate to look at the opportunity set, and today we're going to do it through Scandinavian eyes and discuss the opportunity and playing field with a firm who've been investing there quietly since 1997. Peter Allam Håkansson, CEO of East Capital. Välkommen till London idag och det är fantastiskt att se dig här.
Thank you.
Well,
thank you.
I'm actually happy that you understood my attempt at Swedish.
I did actually very well.
Peter, how young were you when you first visited what might be termed an emerging market?
I guess that must have been when I was in Russia the first time, and that was in 1985, so I'm born 62, so 23 years old.
Right.
I went to a wedding of a good friend who married a Russian lady.
And before we move away from that area, you'd had and you'd written about it in an article that I enjoyed reading, this affiliation through your family with Estonia. Mm-hmm. Just give us a little sense of that history.
Well, that's about 100 years ago. My grandfather, who came from southern Sweden, the part of Sweden called Skåne, from a city called Kristianstad, he left his wife and family back in Sweden to go to Finland and then continued to Estonia for the War of Independence. That was basically the turmoil of the civil war in Russia after the revolution. And he basically felt he wanted to help. And he survived, luckily. He was in in some difficult situation. In one occasion, he was shot upon when he was standing on the armored gun train, which he was responsible for, and his binocular was hit. It fell into pieces, but he survived. And that was good for me, otherwise I wouldn't have been here. And he came back to Sweden again and had more children. One of them was my father. And then, unfortunately, he died when I was only 1 year old, so I didn't really get to know him well. But of course, there were stories about what happened to him. There was his diplomas, his medals from both the Estonian and Finnish state, and also his big saber. So it was a bit intriguing and interesting. And one of these countries, Estonia, didn't exist when I was growing up, which made it even more fascinating. So of course you want to understand how come someone wants to go there and risk their life and all that. And when I was growing up in Sweden, it was really we are very close to Estonia geographically. Tallinn is the closest capital, closer than Helsinki, which is the second closest.
Right.
But it didn't exist really in the mindset of people. And we had this fantastic map, which I loved, which we had in our classrooms. It was one of these old-fashioned maps that you pull down from the ceiling. Maybe you had the same here in the UK. And we had the four countries of the Nordics, Sweden, Finland, Denmark, and Norway, exactly. And you always in a map have this thing which happened, the explanation of this is a road, this is the railway track, and all that. And that covered exactly the area where the Baltic stage should have been. So it was kind of as the air didn't exist. And that made me even more interested. I started to read a lot of history. And when you start to read about Eastern European history, you can't stop, because it's so fascinating, I think.
So before we leave the military history, I noted, and your grandfather would probably have been very intrigued to see that you found yourself as part of the Swedish army surrounding that Russian submarine that emerged in your waters.
Mm-hmm.
Was that just a different day at the office?
That was a fascinating day in the office, and it was the 29th of October 1981. It's another date which I remember, and we were basically doing our military service. I was in the Marines. We were in the biggest naval base of Sweden, which is in Karlskrona. And we heard about this submarine that has stranded further out. And we got wow, fantastic. A big submarine from Soviet here. Maybe they will let us see it. We were a bit naive. So rather, a couple of hours later, we were broken up in the middle of the night and asked to bring our weapons, write contact details for our sort of closest if something should happen to us. And we were basically taken out in trucks. And this was dark. This was, this time of the year, basically now it's very dark in Sweden. And it was snowing, this wet snow. So it was not the nicest time of the year. And we came there and went to the small island, and we saw this huge submarine. It's a massive submarine, and what we didn't know then, but we know now, that it was also armed with nuclear weapons. So you have to be pretty big as a submarine to carry those as well. So we were basically there. The Russians did a rescue attempt the second night we were there, and it was pretty scary, actually. We were in the front line, and we got these updates every 20 minutes on... So now this rescue fleet of three ships are so far away from you, and they will basically hit you in X amount of minutes. And luckily, when they were just about to cross the Swedish territorial water, which was very close to where we were, the Swedish artillery had basically this kind of radar screen that locked. Instead of surveying, they actually locked on the target, and that can be sensed by the boats,
yep.
So they stopped. And but during one time of the evening, there was reports that Spetsnaz had been seen on our neighboring island. And of course, I mean, when you are there, we were 10 guys basically, and we had it was dark. We were manning a big torchlight. There was a diesel aggregator, And it was very noisy. And we understood that the first thing they would take out if they would come for a rescue attempt is basically this torchlight. And we are there. So we knew that we were going to be the first.
Oh my gosh, it's like Tom Clancy's Hunt for Red October.
Yes.
So before we continue this conversation, we're going to take a short break to have a note from our sponsors. I'm thrilled to share that the Money Maze podcast is sponsored by the World Gold Council. They champion the role gold plays as a strategic asset through expert research, commentary, and insights. And it's not just your portfolio that may benefit from gold. Learn how gold mining is supporting female economic empowerment and small businesses via their new documentary series called Gold, The Journey Continues. Tap the link in the show notes to start watching. IFM Investors is a global asset manager, founded and owned by pension funds with capabilities in infrastructure equity and debt, private equity, private credit, and listed equities. They believe healthy returns depend on healthy economic, environmental, and social systems, and these are evolving on a scale never experienced before. To find opportunity, build value, and meet the needs of future generations, you need scale, skill, and expertise. That's what IFM Investors has built up over 30 years.
Well, we'll come back to some of those countries and investments later on. You study at the Stockholm School of Economics and EDEC. Mm-hmm. And I wonder what each of those institutions gave you.
Well, that's a good question. I think when it comes to Stockholm School of Economics, that's the only private university in Sweden. It basically was set up by the Wallenberg family in 1909 to provide management for the Swedish industry. So it's a small school. I think it was only 275 people being admitted every year by that time. So it was kind of, it was tough to get in, but it was a lot of fun once you were in. And it was also a mix of people and coming from all parts of mostly Sweden in those days. And it gave me my wife. We met the first year in the school. So it was a really, really good school from many points of view, from my point.
You've explained about Stockholm School of Economics, but what did EDEC arm you with?
Well, I really wanted to learn another language. I wanted to learn about another culture. And by that time, France was an obvious choice. And it was also, I started to look at the stock markets, and it was a market which I wanted to learn more about. They had just launched the Second Marché in France as well, which was interesting. So, I thought it was an interesting place to be in. And I lived for 4 years. I studied in Ledec, and then I lived for 4 years as well in Paris, working at the stock exchange in Paris.
Well, Swedes consistently rank among the top in Europe for international travel per capita, and as potent entrepreneurial forces who produce those enduring brands, IKEA, Spotify, H&M, Electrolux, not forgetting ABBA. But you select finance, a relatively small area. What drew you for your career into finance?
I started to read these business magazines that my father brought every summer. He brought a lot of magazines, business magazines, to our summer house that he wanted to read up on. And I started to look in them, and I was very much intrigued by the breadth of the Swedish industry and that it was so international, and I was fascinated, and I kind of thought maybe one should start to try and invest my own money a bit, and I started. And it went very well. So from the age of 16, I've really been following the markets on a daily basis. And I actually took my license to become a stockbroker even before I went to Stockholm School of Economics. So I was one of the youngest ever stockbrokers in Sweden.
Okay. Well, I noted that your career involved a large stint at SEB. We all knew that as one of the very respected research firms. And you spent, I think, 9 years there and ended up as global head of research. But the transition from research to portfolio management isn't always easy. Mm. And I wonder what you found most difficult about that.
Well, we can start in a way that when I started my career, I was actually a salesman. Right. And then I went into research. And I think why I wanted to go into portfolio management was that if you're doing classic brokerage, I mean, you live on commission and you want basically people to trade. And I really felt that I was much more long-term rather than short-term in my way of thinking. So I really almost felt bad when I had to get people to trade, although I was pretty good at it. But I really thought that it's much better to find the right investment theme and stick with your with your holdings. And actually, if you write in your conviction, why trade away from it?
Right, salesman with a conscience, that is sometimes infrequent. Yeah. We used to think, and I want to talk about emerging markets now as we get into the meat of your business. We used to think, growing up as I have done, like youth in the industry, that emerging markets typically were the beneficiaries of a weaker dollar and higher commodity prices. Often they went hand in hand. And we might be seeing the beginning of both of those trends, which could be multi-year trends. But is that still a relevant way of looking at emerging markets, except in Latin America?
Well, I think the reason why dollar was so important for the emerging markets was that they were all borrowing so much money. And the kind of currency to borrow in was in dollars. And as emerging markets overall are much less indebted now than they used to be, I think it's less relevant now than it used to be overall.
Which is going to lead me a question I was going to ask you later, but it's appropriate right now, is that although you are an equity firm, the amazing performance of emerging market debt, generally as measured by EMBI and some of these other indices, has pointed to a theme that many have suggested could happen, which is that actually emerging market debt behaves better than developed market debt because there's been this process of rehabilitating country balance sheets, et cetera. Do you think that the debt markets might be ahead of the equity markets?
I think that's quite often the case, that the bond market is ahead of the equity markets. I wouldn't be surprised if it's the same thing here as well. I mean, we have seen it, for example, in the we are doing bonds in our own home market. So we have a Nordic corporate bond fund, which is actually our largest bond fund nowadays. It's had a huge success, especially with investors from continental Europe. And I think one of the things that have contributed to the very strong performance over the last few years has been the bonds for real estate companies. And if you look at the performance of the real estate companies' shares, it has not been good.
Right.
So, yeah, but when looking at it objectively, definitely I think the bond market is making the right move there. So I think we will see the shares follow.
You found the business in 1997. Why?
I was convinced that the fall of the Berlin Wall had created the opportunity of a lifetime in investments. After the fall of the Berlin Wall, that happened when I was living in London, and then I later moved to Paris during this time, I started quite on a regular basis to travel to Eastern Europe as I was interested in history to see how it really looked before things were going to change. And I saw this huge potential. And as I was interested in history, I also knew that the time which I had been growing up in, which is basically during the Cold War and the Iron Curtain, was not the normal stage of Europe, that Europe had been much more, how we say it, common rather than different in history. So I kind of was convinced that this must be an opportunity. So when privatization started in 1994 in most parts of Eastern Europe, we took part of it when I was part of SEB and Skilda, and I really wanted to do more, but I also saw that this was not the right timing for my employer. And I really said, I will regret this the rest of my life. I cannot see my grandchildren in their eyes when they will ask me, "Grandpa, you saw all this, you were there. Why didn't you take the opportunity?" So I thought, I better do it myself.
Well done, you. Many don't. Just give us a recap of the firm today in terms of size, shape, footprint.
We have about 4 billion euros under management. We are basically divided in equal parts between emerging equities, real estate, which is really in Eastern Europe, and developed markets and in equities and bonds. And it's 18 funds, and we are about 80 people. We have our head office in Stockholm. We have our fund management company in Luxembourg, and where we are registered. And then we have research in Hong Kong, Mumbai, and Dubai. And we also have real estate operations with offices in Tallinn, Riga, and Vilnius.
Okay. So let's talk about the investment philosophy. As I read through your materials, I quote, "We favor investments in companies that show long-term sustainable growth and have responsible owners." Mm. Most fund managers would say that that's an aspiration as well. I guess, what do you think that you do specifically, or at least very well, that distinguishes you in this space?
I think what we have been trying to find, I mean, we've always been looking for growth. I think that's kind of in our DNA, that we want to find companies. We are stock pickers, and we want to find companies that show growth. So we try to pick areas which we think are interesting, and then we try to find the best companies in those areas. And when it comes to responsible owners, which I think was mentioned, that was a very early lesson from our days in Eastern Europe, when it was very difficult to understand who were the owners, and we understood that this was key. And I mean, I still think that it's so important to understand the owners of a company, no matter where they are, because it's the owner who set the tone for the governance in the company. If there's not the right governance, shareholders will not have a part of the wealth creation of the company anyhow. So you need to know the owners.
And we're going to talk about this research process, but one of the articles that that I'd been through in researching you was that you said when in the early days you went to visit companies in Russia, mm-hmm. a telltale sign of bad cash flows or absent cash flows was going in winter when the rooms were really, really cold, i.e. there was no heating. And it reminded me, we'd interviewed Carson Block, the famous short seller, and he said he went to see a paper company in China, but there was moisture everywhere. And the consultant he'd taken with them said, they're not making much paper with this level of moisture in it. So what have you learned about those road trips, site visits that have become baked into your DNA?
I think that still is so important just to go and see companies. I have done thousands of company visits, and I really think it's amazing this gut feeling you have when you enter into only the reception of a company. I get a feeling for how it's run. It's kind of, and of course you want to go and see, speak to people, you want to see the production facilities, but it tells you a lot. And no, it's been fantastic times. And you mentioned about this in the winter time, and maybe I should just add as well, because one of the reasons why it was so difficult to analyze companies in that time, it was barter trade. So it meant that even all the companies were producing annual reports, but it didn't really mean anything. So this was the best research criteria. I mean, it never failed. If it was cold, it was a sell. If it was warm, it was a buy, to put it very short. I mean, we have refined the research methods over the years, but that was the early start.
But let me just stay with that idea that the site visits are so important. There is something that you are ready to observe. If you were taking a young portfolio manager or analyst mm-hmm. with you, what would you advise him or her to develop as a skill that helps you sense something that isn't in the numbers?
I mean, it's all things about how things are organized in an office, and just to see how you're welcomed, what type of atmosphere you have when you... I mean, there's always this type of atmosphere in the company, how you're welcomed, how people speak to each other, and all these kind of small and fine, which are very important things, but that you cannot see in the numbers.
And the approach to research varies by institution. Some want boots on the ground and people in all mm-hmm. those places. You mentioned the centers that you have, but how do you organize, having been head of research at an institution before, mm-hmm. East Capital, how do you organize your research analysts? Are they sectorally focused? Are they multidiscipline?
They are multidiscipline, and they are then following different markets, really.
Right.
And I mean, for example, in our emerging markets space, Asia is the most important part of the world by far. And 5 of the 8 people who work with our emerging market fund, our global emerging market fund, are based in Asia. So they are pretty close to where the action is, basically.
So before we continue this conversation, we're going to take a short break to have a note from our sponsors. I'm excited to announce that the Money Maze podcast is sponsored by the London Stock Exchange Group, known as LSEG. At the heart of the global economy, LSEG provides data, analytics, and infrastructure that connects investors, businesses, and economies. LSEG is where ideas meet capital, enabling sustainable growth and opportunity. Tap the link in the show notes to learn more. Schroders Capital is the private markets division of Schroders. Combining the experience, the specialized local teams with the scale, rigor, and resources of a global institutional platform. Schroders Capital provides its clients with global access to differentiated and specialized strategies encompassing all private markets asset classes, from private equity to real estate.
infrastructure, and the broad universe of private debt and credit alternatives. This approach enables Schroders Capital to access opportunities and investments that are often difficult to find elsewhere, while also having the broad capabilities and perspectives needed to build holistic solutions and deliver tailored outcomes across private markets for both institutional and wealth clients. Discover more at schroderscapital.com. Remember, capital is at risk with investing.
And again, going back to your philosophy, you write, we focus on companies with strong and predictable cash flows. And you say at the end of this piece, fundamentals matter over time. Mm-hmm. And I wonder which for you fundamentals matter most.
I think what we try to assess is to find really good quality companies that have this ability to show sustainable growth over time. And also have a good corporate governance. So we have kind of this kind of quality measurement model that we look after. So that's the long term. But of course, in the short term, if you have these type of companies, it's the valuation which really matters mostly. So it's a combination of the short term effect and the longer term perspective.
And are there industries that you would naturally feel more comfortable? I'm saying consumer discretionary versus mm-hmm. finance. Is that sort of, you know, because when I look at the portfolio, what I see is that the country deviations are generally modest, but the stock deviations versus their bets are much more pronounced.
Yeah.
Is that fair?
Absolutely. We are stock pickers.
Right.
By nature. And that's really where we can add value. And I think that's where we are adding value and why we are still relevant after 30 years.
Well, and I've seen your performance and it's very impressive, but just take me through the idea building process, because there aren't that many companies, you know, that are big enough and liquid mm-hmm. enough and appealing enough, and some you will presumably have owned before. But when you find a new idea that isn't in the portfolio mm. and you think about sizing, just talk me through, you know, the approach that you might typically take.
As you rightly point out, we want to make sure that we don't deviate too much when it comes to the country level and then on the global emerging market fund, which is the flagship fund really. And then we really want to understand if it is a company if you have a company in that sort of country. And you wanted to really make an effect in the performance, you want it to be larger than the index weight to start with. So you have to be index aware.
Yep.
And then, so that's a good starting point as well. But of course, you want to make sure that you find interesting companies. And how do we find them? Well, we have screening processes where we try and meet them one way or another, and we have to do our own research and see that we actually. Is our predictions different from the market? Because we understand also if it will not react, if it's not kind of something that is very much in line with the market, we have to find something which is different to make sure we create some alpha. And then, of course, you have the FX effect when it comes to the emerging markets, that if it is a weak currency, you want to be more focused on an exporter. If it's a strong currency, it's the other way around.
So there are two parts I'm intrigued about to the Asian question. Mm-hmm. China obviously dominates the indices, and there's been a risk aversion practiced by many large American investors. Mm-hmm. Do you sense that the flows are changing, number one? And number two, what would you say is the mood on the ground when you're in Asia of those companies?
I would say that we have seen, basically for the last year, we have seen a marked change in the view of China. I know there's quite a few people who will not touch China ever for different reasons, but I think there's a lot of people who are, they've been hesitating a bit about China. And when they start to see the performance and they start to see that actually tech is important for everything in the world. And if you really want to be part of what's happening technology-wise, we all know that NVIDIA is fantastic, but where do they produce the chips? It's TSMC in Taiwan. And you can give so many examples. And of course, the valuation is much lower in TSMC than it is for NVIDIA, which is participating in the same growth pattern. And you can see the same thing if you look on the EVs, where you have Tesla, and then you have the BYD, which valuation, which is a fraction of Tesla. Of course, there's different parts of Tesla which can be attributed with different value, this robotization and other things. But I just think that when people started to look at China again about 1 year ago and see, wow, there's so many things happening here, and the valuation is just super cheap compared to everything else, it really meant that people revisited the topic, and we have seen quite nice flows into the markets again.
And Chris Wood from Greed and Fear, who we're going to come back, who has a question for you later on, he's been commenting on these developing markets forever. His observation is that when we looked at DeepSeek, it's symptomatic of the fact that Chinese technology and AI is absolutely going to be there, and it's going to be there just as much as the US. And perhaps there is a Western, perhaps particularly an American, propensity to underestimate just how permanent, present, powerful those Chinese enterprises are.
Absolutely. DeepSeek was really the trigger for it all. And that started people to revisit. And then when Alibaba started to be seen as more relevant again with Jack Ma coming back, we have seen so much interest in China since then.
So whilst your emerging market business is very important and larger, you have a frontier markets business. Mm-hmm. And as I looked at it, Vietnam, Egypt, Slovenia, Nigeria, the UK, and I thought, the UK, I know things are bad, but I didn't realize we're a frontier market. But I see the 4 or 5% obviously relates to a frontier market listed company listed in the UK. But
I think it's the Georgian exposure.
Okay, thank you. Have you learnt different lessons in the frontier markets about the investment process?
Well, the frontier markets are by nature less developed. The definition of emerging in frontier markets by MSCI, which we normally are following, is really the state of development of the capital markets. So it really means that you have less sophisticated markets to work in. You have a problem sometimes with currency control, and to be able to withdraw your currency, and you also have the problems with less developed corporate governance. So you have to be a bit more careful. You have to be maybe even more on the ground and closer to the companies. But it's good. It's perfect for us because that's what we've been doing the whole of our life. So we think we can add even better value in these markets.
Well, you answered a question I had in part earlier on, and that's back to currency. I happen to be personally an investor in Krispy Kreme Nigeria, private company.
That sounds fascinating.
And they're in the pizza and the ice cream business, and I look at the reports, and top line, the business goes very well. Mm. When you adjust it for the Nigerian, I think it's the Nairu, the FX losses mount, and it looks like a significantly less clever investment by me. Mm-hmm. You hinted at it, but particularly as we go into the frontier markets, how do you think about what is a propensity for those countries to have inherently weak currencies?
Yeah, it is very, very important, and it really means everything in the end, basically, how that also plays out. And you cannot really hedge those currencies as well because you pay too much for the hedge. Yep. So the only way to actually handle it is what I talked about before a bit, that you actually position yourself depending on the currency in either exporters or domestic exposure. That's the only way to play it if you really want to make sure that you handle the FX.
And the great investors, of course, have learned from their battle scars. We interviewed, and it's now going back probably 4 years, Mark Mobius, who for a long time was deemed to be the great Templeton emerging market investor. And he said that one of the things that always unnerved him was cross-shareholdings of companies in developing markets where one principal might have a stake in various other businesses. What lessons have you learned along the way that have become quite an important part of your process?
You mean in frontier markets?
All markets, actually.
I think the number one lesson for us has really been the importance of the shareholders, the other owners. Because if you really understand I cannot underemphasize the importance of having the right owners, because that really signals everything. And I mean, if you look at, for example, if you look on ESG investing, which has been a very important topic for many, many years, if the G is not working, don't care about the E or the S because it will never be implemented. So it's the same thing also for the valuation. If you want to see a company being valued properly, you have to have proper G because otherwise the shareholders will not take part of it.
And when you sit around with your team and they've been on their research sort of visits and you're listening and talking about the portfolio and where would you say, either at a country or at an industry level, across those emerging and frontier markets, where are they most obviously excited about the investment opportunities?
I think it's really two areas which are really on top of mind at the moment. One is the obvious one, which we have touched upon in Asia, where you see all this new technology coming on stream. And if you really want to be part of new technology, you have to be in Asia. And most of the time, you have to be in China. That's the harsh reality. And we saw it so much when it comes to wind and solar. I mean, it doesn't really pay to look at anywhere else. And we see the same now with batteries. We see the same thing with chips manufacturing, not maybe in China, but then it's rather Korea and Taiwan instead. So you have to, I mean, this is the part of the world where it's all happening. The other area, which I think is also interesting, is closer to us. That's Eastern Europe, where we see there will be peace sooner or later. All wars end with peace. It might not be a good peace, but there will be peace sooner or later, and there will be build up. And that will definitely benefit a big part of the Eastern and Central European markets. On top of that, they're already now doing quite well. I mean, we see that Poland, for example, I think the average growth of GDP for the last 25 years in Poland is 3.8%.
Yes, yes.
It's not China, but it's not far from China either. And that's here in Europe, it's 40 million people. And we can give more and more examples. I mean, the Baltics have done extremely well as well. Not so good as Poland, but you also have Romania has been done tremendously as well. So,
You preempted again. You're very good at this. One of the questions I was going to ask, which was Ukraine. Ah. There will be a rebuild at some point in time under terms unknowable right now. Obviously, American footprint will probably be all over it in terms of some of the beneficiaries. Mm-hmm. But just give us a sense of, you know, where the investment opportunities are most likely to lie.
I mean, the most obvious is, of course, everything which has to do to rebuild all the real estate and factories and everything which has been ruined that needs to be built up again. But apart from that, I really think one area which is interesting, which we started to see some interest in even before the war, was actually nearshoring, because you have really a good and well-educated workforce in Ukraine. It's I think it would be logical to see, especially in Western Ukraine, a buildup of the kind of industries that moved from Germany to Poland, to Slovakia, to Hungary, that they move even further east.
Right.
I think that would be very natural.
We're going to talk about your investors in a minute, but if you are a prospective investor and you're looking at that territory and thinking, well, I don't have very much there, does that play to your emerging market fund more than to your frontier fund?
You have a bigger exposure in the frontier market fund.
Right.
We also have a sort of dedicated fund, which is called New Europe, which only does this part of the world, actually.
Okay.
So for those who really want to have a true exposure of it, that's another alternative. And it's been, I think, the fastest growing fund this year, actually.
Right.
Because if you look at the performance this year of markets, South Korea has been tremendous.
Yes.
But apart from that, in Europe, you have seen both Greece and Poland done extremely well.
Yeah. And when we think about your investors, are they typically drawn from the institutional community, A, and B, geographically, very concentrated near to home, or?
No, it's been very international, actually. When we started, it was really very much the retail investors that saw the opportunities. But I would say for the last almost 20 years, even longer, it has been institutional predominantly. And it's been very much either big pension funds in continental Europe or sovereign wealth funds globally. And then it's been more mandates that we are running on those guys. So it has been very much concentrated on those. We have seen a pickup of interest from retail investors more recently, but it's still a very small part of the business.
So we now have this section in our interviews, we call it the Outsiders Inquiry. And I had two great thinkers who offered questions. One is Peter Frankopan, who's head of global history at Oxford and the author of The Silk Roads. And he said, which country or countries won't be in the giant emerging market bucket in 10 years because they've grown up and out?
I think the most logical ones would be Asian countries that have that should, I would say, develop into developed markets. And I think that would be South Korea and Taiwan. Those are the most likely contenders. And if you look to Europe, I think it would be Poland, Czechia.
And of course, now I'm thinking about that. Are there any candidates that might fall out of the bottom and go down into the frontier cohort?
Well, that's a good question. I think, and because you never know.
Yes.
And I think it's, one of the difficulties when you're an investor is that these indices, they tend to change.
Yes.
And it can be very unpredictable. We for example, if you look at one of the interesting new countries that we have been investing in for the last 10 years, maybe, is Saudi Arabia, which was not in any indices when we started to invest in it. And it didn't go the way through a frontier market. It went directly into emerging markets.
Right.
And all of a sudden, you have these big shifts. And also in frontier markets, you have, if Vietnam should move up into emerging market, it would mean a lot of difficulties for the frontier market indices. And yeah, who would fall out? Yeah, I mean, of course, Russia has already fallen out, which would be the number one, I guess. I think if you have some of the liquidity drying up in some of the smaller Eastern European markets, they could come down from emerging to frontier. But like Hungary, for example, that has had its troubles as well with the currency and the high interest rates.
Well, I mentioned Chris Wood earlier on, author of Greed and Fear, and his question was, you had in your early days, East Capital had been very associated with its very successful Russian investments. Mm-hmm. We all know what happened in Russia. What have you learned from that whole Russian saga?
That you should never be too exposed to one country, I guess. No, I think we have learned a lot. Russia has been a fascinating place to be investing in. It has been difficult, but on the other hand, that has been our job. And it was, of course, very sad when you started to see the development of things that started to happen. And we saw the first signs, of course, like most other people in 2014 with Crimea. And ever since 2014, we have very deliberately tried to lessen our exposure to Russia as a firm. But of course, it was still a big exposure in 2022 when things started to go very bad. And it was tough for the company.
Yes.
But we managed to survive that and I think have built an even better company after that.
So I'm going to ask you some general, closing, unrelated questions, possibly the harder questions.
Okay.
Now, I read that you are a music fanatic. You love your music. If you could have dinner with one musician who's alive anywhere in the world, who would you have dinner with?
I mean, if I look at my record collection, I think I have the most records with people. It's very British, by the way. David Bowie, Steve Harley, and Ray Davies, and also Big Country. And since three of them are dead, and yes, one is alive. So I think it would be Ray Davies from the Kings.
Okay. I'm not sure I can help you there, although my wife just on her podcast interviewed the head of Warner Brothers Music, I might have to ask her.
That would be
her.
Fantastic.
The second thing is advice for youth. It's always important on our show. We have, we sponsored and we do a lot of work with young people. What advice would you give a young person thinking about our business?
I think it is a fantastic business to be in. It's really, you are paid to be curious and you're paid to ask questions. And you can ask stupid questions, it doesn't really matter. And you meet the most fascinating people in the world, all these entrepreneurs in all different countries and sectors. I think it's a dream job. So I would just, if you're interested in what's happening in the world, if you're curious, this is the dream.
Now, on your travels, and you have been to a lot of emerging, frontier, developing countries, have you had a particularly frightening or scary experience?
Yeah, definitely. We have had quite a few meetings where we have kind of, well, quite a few, but we have had meetings where we realized after a while that maybe we should pack up our stuff and be leaving.
Right.
And not ask more questions.
Okay.
And that was, of course, in the early days in Russia. That you, there was, it was a time where there was, most companies were not listed. There were, there had been privatizations, and you realize that someone was trying to basically buy up all the shares from the workers cheaply. And of course, if you come in as a as an international investor and also try to compete for those shares, it wasn't very popular. So sometimes we just realized it was time to leave.
And finally, if you love your food, and we have colleague Celine in the room with the recording, and she's a serious foodie, mm-hmm. maker, eater, consumer, etc., where would we be most surprised by the delicious food we might eat?
Uzbekistan, I guess.
Uzbekistan. And what might it be that you eat in Uzbekistan?
You eat plov.
Sorry?
Plov. Which is basically pilaf.
Okay.
So they call it plov. And it's fantastic. And it's, I mean, when you're traveling around in old, in the old countries of Soviet Union, I think, I mean, there are two countries that really stands out for the food, and that's Uzbekistan and Georgia.
Right.
But Georgia, I guess, is more famous these days, yes. And if people have discovered it and they know all about the wines. But I still think Uzbekistan is about to be discovered. Maybe you have some good restaurants here in Uzbekistan in London. I guess, okay. And you have everything in London, so I guess.
Well, thank you. It may not be quite so authentic, but that's great. So I'm just going to wrap up. Peter, it's been great to have you here in the office. It's been great to understand your space, as I have been in this business for a long time. There was a period when I was at Morgan Stanley when emerging markets for a number of years were the only thing anybody wanted to talk about. And we are absolutely at the other end of that spectrum. And I am instinctively a contrarian investor, so I am intrigued by this opportunity. It's been great to learn a little bit about these frontier markets as well, some of which one might not even think of as a frontier market, which, as we know, is part of the classification problem, which, you know, our industry loves to box things, and therefore it labels things, and then it works until it doesn't work, and some go up and some go down. But it does strike me that there is reason to be much more constructive by what's happening. And if we go all the way back to the earlier discussion on these emerging market debt indices, and they reflect a healing and a lower risk and maybe some recovery from the punishment that they felt. I remember back to 1998 when the Indonesian rupiah, you know, fell 75%, and all those Asian currencies who had borrowed in you know, dollars paid huge prices. But, you know, we're in a new cycle right now. So good luck
Thank
with
you.
Your mission. It's been terrific to have you here.
Thanks a lot for having me.